Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Good evening, and welcome to the Tattered Cover. I want to thank you all for coming tonight, and also thank you for your continuing support of the Tattered Cover and other independent bookstores around the country. We really appreciate your coming to events like this and your purchasing books. It's what allows us to do special events like tonight. We are very honored tonight to have Senator George McGovern here with his new book, Abraham Lincoln, the American President series. Born in Avon, South Dakota, George McGovern served in the House of Representatives from 1957 to 1961. He continued to serve in the U.S. Senate for 18 years. And in 1972, he was the Democratic Party's nominee for president. There were several of us here that were confiding to each other, that was my first vote, to be able to vote for McGovern. You know, you remember that pretty well when you're old enough, you know. From 1991 to 1998, he served as the president of the Middle East Policy Council. President Clinton then appointed him to his current post as ambassador to the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization. This is where George McGovern continues in his leadership to end world hunger. And now, will you please help me welcome Senator George McGovern?
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I must say it's wonderful to see a full house on a Monday night. Do we have Monday night football? No? Well, that's all the more impressive that we got this place filled. I'm aware that there are a number of people who worked for me back in 1972. I've always thought, when I think about that great army that we pulled together across this country, that while we didn't have the most people, I've always thought we had the best people. And that, I've also learned years ago that there are some things that can happen to you that are even worse than losing an election. It's hard to think what they are on election night, but I've never had any overwhelming desire to trade places with the man who defeated me so soundly. I don't say that because he's dead and I'm alive. Even when he was alive, I felt that we told the American people the truth in 1972. Some of it was hard truth. It's very hard to oppose a war once American troops are committed, but I'm convinced we were on the right track then, and I think we have a president now who's on the right track. He's trying very hard to get some kind of understanding with the other party in the Senate. It's not easy right now. There seems to be more partisanship and bitterness in politics these days than there was when I was a member of the United States Senate. Today, I work hand in glove with former Senator Bob Dole, a Republican presidential nominee, as I was the Democratic nominee. And we don't agree on a lot of things, but we agree on some things. And those are the things we're working together on in trying to reduce hunger in the world. When I was in Rome as the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. agencies that are located there, which deal with the problems of hunger, I got an idea that the best way to reduce hunger in the world as a first big step would be to provide a good nutritious lunch every day for every hungry school-aged child in the world. Yes. And I think if we had done that in Iraq, this program's called the McGovern-Dole bill. I think if we had taken that program to Iraq through the United Nations, not just the United States alone, but with us in the lead, I think we'd have been better off than sending our troops into that country, and I think it would have had a better impact on the people of Iraq. I think the same thing about Afghanistan. I have the highest regard for President Obama, and I desperately want him to be a great president. I want every president, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, to be great, because they have our interests in their hands, and we have to hope that they represent those interests well. I know the president thinks it was wise to send 21,000 more troops into Afghanistan. That means we now have 68,000 there. I hope they know what they're doing, but I have grave doubts about it. And there again, I think if in that poor country where so many people are in poverty, if we could have established there a countrywide program to provide a good, nutritious school lunch every day, it would have done more good than sending our army in there. I hope I'm wrong about that, because I always want American troops to do well once they're committed to battle. In Afghanistan, you have a problem that these Taliban and some other groups in the country don't believe that girls should go to school. That's true in a number of countries, but especially in Afghanistan. But if you set up a school lunch program in a country like that, you can tell the managers of that locality that that program won't operate unless it's open to both boys and girls. And ordinarily, they'll bend the customs to accommodate you. Well, now that has nothing to do with the Lincoln book, but I always want to get a few things in here. Anyway, I wrote this book on Abraham Lincoln. It's part of a series that includes every president with special attention to the years that they were in the White House, in Lincoln's case, 4 years before he was killed. The editor-in-chief of that series was the late Arthur Schlesinger, and he stopped me in a restaurant in New York about 3 years ago and told me that he was the editor of this series. And he said, I want you to do one of the presidents. Take your choice, and unless somebody else has already spoken for it. I said, well, I'd like Abraham Lincoln. He said, too bad. Bill Clinton has spoken for Lincoln. He said, this may come as a surprise to you, George, but some people think it's more important to actually get elected president than it is just to get nominated. And he said, I realize that's odd thinking, but we had to yield to the president on that. Anyway, I said, well, I'm too busy anyway, Arthur. I'll take a pass on that this time. A year later, he calls me and says, guess what? Bill Clinton just phoned me. It was about midnight, and saying he can't do that book. So it's yours if you want it. So that's how I got Abraham Lincoln. I owe Bill Clinton a favor for that. I think Abraham Lincoln was not only the greatest man ever to occupy the White House, I think he was the greatest president, and we've had some great ones, not the least George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Franklin Roosevelt, and others. I think he was a great man partly because of his great personal achievements in overcoming two seemingly impossible handicaps. He only had 1 year of formal schooling. Even after I got a Ph.D. in history at Northwestern University, almost as good as the University of Denver. I still had days when I wondered if I was fully ready to be president of the United States. Imagine Lincoln with 1 year, but in that 1 year, he learned to read. And secondly, he learned how to write. And he never quit. He was reading for the rest of his life. He had a falling out with his father when he was growing up, first in Kentucky and then in Indiana, because his father was a farmer. And Lincoln was a big, strong, husky guy, and his father wanted him to do farm work. And he did a certain amount of it, but very frequently his father would find him leaning against a tree, reading a book. And they had a number of battles over that got quite severe with the passage of time, to the point where Lincoln finally left home and didn't even attend his father's funeral, which was too bad that he had that break with his father. Fortunately, his mother, who was a wonderful woman, died far too young, but she saw Lincoln's mental abilities. She saw the intellectual capabilities, and she encouraged him to read everything he could get his hand on. He knew the King James Version of the Bible thoroughly, cover to cover. He knew Shakespeare. He read books like Pilgrim's Progress, Robert Burns' poetry, and other things. Went on and on. He read everything that he could get his hands on. And after his first mother died, the second mother was every bit as attentive to Lincoln. She saw his abilities, and she encouraged him to read everything that he could and to do all the writing he could. So he worked at those two things, reading and writing, for the rest of his life. He became, I think, one of the best read presidents that we've had. And he had a retentive mind that enabled him to hold a lot of that wisdom. He also, in my opinion, was the best writer that ever served in the White House. We all know about the Gettysburg Address, only 270 words long, but that's a real literary gem. Of the people, by the people, for the people. A pretty good definition of democracy. And his two inaugural addresses were masterpieces. A speech he made in Peoria, Illinois, and another one in New York City are real classics. And he worked hard on those speeches, sometimes for several weeks on a single speech. He would read a number of works that bore on the subjects he wanted to talk about. He would read the speeches of people like Henry Clay and others whom he admired. And then he would sit down and labor over a first draft. It might take him several days. It might take him a week or more. And when he had it as well as he thought he could, he'd call in some member of the cabinet, and Lincoln would read the speech, and the other person would take notes on certain things that they thought were fuzzy or a little dull. And in one case, Seward was listening to him deliver the speech, and he caught a phrase that he thought was a little dull and also a little vague, and he suggested that Lincoln refer, instead of to that particular passage, appeal to the American people by saying, by referring to the better angels of our nature. I've always thought that was a great phrase. Instead of just said, we should do good, or we should do the best we could, he said, the better angels of our nature. That was Seward's idea, Secretary Seward, the Secretary of State, former senator from New York, who was one of Lincoln's rivals. So anyway, the point I'm making here is that here's a young guy from a little country village that became one of the best red presidents we've ever had, and probably the best writer we ever had in the White House. The other big personal handicap that he had to overcome is what today we would call clinical depression. Lincoln referred to it as melancholy, and there was no treatment for it. No Paxil, no Prozac, no lithium, no electric shock therapy, nothing like that. Doctors didn't know what it was. They just knew that sometimes people became so sad and so depressed they were unable to eat. They're unable to work. They're unable to carry on normal relations with people. And Lincoln had that. He, as a young man, several times seriously considered suicide. He was so miserable. When he was 32 years old, he told a member of the Illinois State Senate that he thought he was the most miserable man on this earth. He told one of the senators in the Illinois State Legislature that he had given up carrying a knife for fear when he was in one of these moods of deep despondency that he would slit his throat or slit his wrists. This was a terrible handicap. I know a little about it because We've had that in my family. My daughter, Terry, from the time she was a teenager, suffered from deep depression. She finally discovered that one thing that would work if she was going out to a party was to drink a couple of glasses of vodka, and then she felt great, and she'd have a great time at the party, and then feel terrible by the time she had gone to bed or gotten up the next morning. It eventually led her into alcoholism, and we lost her one night. She left a treatment center, and everything went fine that day. She called up some of her old friends, and then she went to go to a little market to get some things for an apartment that I had helped her get, and she met a friend of hers, one of the Vietnam GIs, and he said, "Terry, let's just go and have one Christmas toast." 3 hours later, when she stumbled out into the snowbank, she was not found until the afternoon, the next afternoon, when she was frozen to death. So I know a little bit about depression and about alcoholism. With women, very frequently the two go together. Women alcoholics, while they're not as numerous as us males, they die at double the rate of male alcoholics. Nobody knows for sure just why. I think it's partly the sense of shame. Us males can walk into a bar like the Marlboro Man and throw down a couple of shots, and if we stagger a little, nobody thinks anything of it. But if a woman staggers and falls, she feels like a tramp. So that may have something to do with it. But in any event, Lincoln never drank. He was a teetotaler, and he had to just take this depression without any kind of relief. He was in his office one day when a delegation of women were waiting out in the reception area to see him, and they heard the president laughing. There were two or three men with him, and they heard several guffaws coming from the White House. So when they got in, they thanked the president for seeing them, but the spokesman for the group said, "Mr. President, we would be less than honest if we didn't tell you that we were shocked to hear you laughing in the president's office, the young Americans dying both north and south. How could anybody be laughing at a time like this?" He said, "Well, ma'am, I appreciate your feeling. I can understand that. But I must tell you, if I could not occasionally laugh, I think my heart would break and all the business of this office would cease." One of the paradoxes of American history is that nobody hated war more than Lincoln, and yet he had to. This is Barack asking me what to do next. Wants to know what to do about Afghanistan, I guess. Anyway, Lincoln sometimes would tell humorous stories, even during the Civil War, to help combat the terrible depression that he felt inside. So I think a man that can overcome an education of only 1 year and can overcome clinical depression, as he did most of the time, is a remarkable human being. Lincoln thought his greatest achievement as president was the Emancipation Proclamation. I would respectfully disagree with that. The Emancipation Proclamation did free the slaves in the South, but that was the Confederacy, and we were engaged with their army, and there wasn't much that the president could do to see that the slaves had been emancipated. Some of them did walk away, but I think that it wasn't until the 13th Amendment that we really had really lived up to our Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. And Lincoln, of course, supported that. But I think his greatest achievement was that he saved the American Union. We came close in those years of the 1960s of losing the United States of America, breaking up into two separate countries. We might have eventually gotten together anyway at some point. I don't know. Nobody else knows. But the point is that the one thing Lincoln would not compromise on was the Union. And the way he thought the best way to preserve it was not to permit a single slave in any of the new states coming in or in any of the publicly owned territories. No slavery anywhere except in the 11 states where it already existed. And that's where he issued the Emancipation Proclamation. But Lincoln believed, let me go back just a moment here. He said before the Civil War, in an effort to keep the South in the Union, if I could save the Union by freeing all of the slaves, that's what I would do. If I could save the Union by freeing none of the slaves, that's what I would do. If I could save the Union by freeing some of the slaves and holding others, which is what he did, I would do that. But the Union has to be preserved. And he would not budge on that. And that's why he put his foot down on any slavery anywhere except in the Confederate South. And once the war ended, those slaves, of course, would be freed under the Emancipation Proclamation. Some of them walked away over the objection of their masters. But I think that was a great achievement. There were just very quickly, there were some other things other than the Civil War going on then. The Homestead Act, 1862, right in the middle of the Civil War, that set the pattern of family farm agriculture in this country for the next 100 years. The Land-Grant College Acts, which created Colorado State and South Dakota State and all the other state colleges. Very important piece of legislation, which Lincoln pushed. The creation of the Department of Agriculture. For many years, that was the biggest department of the government until the Pentagon came along in more recent times. And then they completed the Transcontinental Railway from Omaha and Council Bluffs all the way to Sacramento. Those are four pretty big things that had nothing to do with the Civil War. So I think the Lincoln administration was very productive both in legislation and in the way the president managed the Civil War. He had all kinds of trouble with his generals until he got Grant and Sherman, and one of his aides told him one day that they'd picked up rumors that Grant was drinking, and you know that story. Lincoln said, "Find out what he's drinking and give it to the rest of my generals." Anyway, I'll be happy now to answer a few questions. They don't have to be just about the Lincoln book if you want to know who's going to win the World Series or something like that. And anything that you want me to comment on, I'll be happy to, yes.
Talk about being a liberal.
Well, I've always been a liberal since I hit the ripe old age of 18. I grew up as a conservative. My mother and father lived and died as conservative Republicans. But when I watched what the New Deal did for South Dakota, the farm program, the REA, Social Security, guaranteed bank deposits, the Tennessee Valley Authority, all these things, collective bargaining for working people, all these things convinced me to take another look at these so-called liberals. And I'm not against conservatives. I don't like the kind we've had the last 8 years, but I don't think they call themselves neoconservatives. I don't think they were conservatives. I think they were extremists, way out on the right fringe of American politics. But I'm not against honest-to-goodness conservatives. I think we need a good conservative party in this country, and we need a good liberal party. And they both should present their case as intelligently as they can. Then you have a vote and decide what you're going to do. But I believe in the conservative party, and I believe in the liberal party. I have to tell you that the reason my dad and mother were conservatives is because they thought Roosevelt spent too much money. Do you know how much the New Deal cost? For 7 years, 1933 to 1940, the total for 7 years, $49 million. $7 million a year, you know. We spend that much on loose change every day now. So, but what does alarm me, and I think would alarm my parents if they were alive today, we have a national debt today of $14 trillion. I'm just getting used to billions, but now trillions, 1,000 billion. And we got 14 of those 1,000 billions, and that does worry me. And I don't think it's conservatism. I don't think it's liberalism either. I think it's folly. That's what those wars did to us. The war in Iraq added $3 trillion, and then there was another trillion added. And so. But I'm a proud liberal. What I say to my conservative friends, name me one program that was a positive, constructive contribution, like Social Security or guaranteed bank deposits or REA for electricity on the farm. Name me one of those positive programs that we all now generally agree are good that didn't begin as a liberal initiative over conservative opposition. I can't think of any. Somebody said in one of the audiences that the interstate highway system came into being in the Eisenhower administration, but all the Democrats voted for it. What I said is, name me one positive program that was not initially opposed by conservatives over and the Democrats overrode it. So we supported the interstate highway, so you can't cite that.
Eisenhower had his liberal moments.
He did. The best thing Eisenhower ever did was that farewell address when he said that we had to worry about the mounting power of the military-industrial complex. I've always thought that was as wise a piece of information as we've ever been given in a farewell address. And I regret to say I love Jack Kennedy, but the first thing he did after that speech when he was sworn in was to add $10 billion to the Pentagon budget. Remember the missile gap? In that 1960, there wasn't a missile gap. Well, there was a gap, but it was in our favor. The Russians were the ones who were behind. No, I have a high regard. I was one of the nicest compliments, at least one that I treasure a great deal. Three or four years ago, I was in New Orleans, and I was sitting on the platform with a group of people. We were getting ready to dedicate the World War II Museum. This is Stephen Ambrose's passion. And there was an elderly gentleman next to me on the platform, snow white hair. And I didn't know who he was, and he leaned over to me and just said rather softly, because we were just waiting for the program to start, he said, "Senator McGovern, I've been wanting to tell you something if I ever saw you. President Eisenhower had the highest regard for you." I treasure that. General Goodpaster was Ike's top military aide, and everybody loved General Goodpaster. Most people loved Ike. But anyway, that meant a lot to me because what I think it meant is that somebody called Eisenhower's attention that practically every time I made a speech, I would quote President Eisenhower's farewell address. So he must have thought I was a great guy. Yeah,
thank you. Thank you for a lifetime of service. And I'm just wondering, as you look back now, the arc of history that you've been so important to, one of the disappointing things I think I see now is just this distrust in the government and how we can get back to a place where
you know, I think I don't know him as well as some people do, but I think Barack Obama is a truthful man. That doesn't mean he can always speak the truth. Sometimes it's hard to find the truth on a particular issue, but I think we can count on him to say what he thinks is the truth rather than trying to deceive people. And that will go a long way to restoring confidence in the White House and in the presidency. When I ran in 72, I announced in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where I made my announcement that I was going to run, that I make one pledge above all others, and that is to seek and to speak the truth. And I stayed with that to the best of my ability. I asked Lyndon Johnson what he thought of that pledge, and he said, "Well, I can tell you, George, it's easier to speak the truth than it is to find it." And there may be some truth in that, you know. I have a different view on health care than some people. I don't know whether I'm right or not, but I thought the mistake that was made by Hillary Clinton 16 years ago is that she ended up with a 1,300-page bill I don't know how many people here have ever read a 1,300-page bill, you know, that fine print, but I certainly haven't. I think that President Obama's tried to come up with a more simplified proposal, but if by some miracle I had been elected in 72, what I would have proposed is that we simply extend Medicare to everybody. Yeah. Yes. We all know what Medicare is. It just means the government pays your doctor and hospital bills. I've had it since I turned 65. I think it's wonderful. I want to tell you, I needed it a lot more when I was a young professor at Dakota Wesleyan or a graduate student at Northwestern. Boy, it would have helped then. We had five children, and my salary, Don Messer is here. He can verify this is about where salaries were in those days. I got $4,500 a year. If I taught summer school, I got $6,000 a year. I got $900 for working all summer. Anyway, when you've got five children and a beautiful wife, it's hard to get along on either $4,500 a year or $6,000 a year. All the dollars bought a lot more then than they do now. But if we'd have had Medicare, it sure would have helped a lot. And if you stop to think about it, why is it logical to give Medicare to people like me and not to my grandchildren or not to my kids who are no longer kids? They've got kids of their own. So I think instead of some big complicated bill, I just have one sentence. Congress hereby extends Medicare to all Americans. Period. I have an article in yesterday's Washington Post, the Sunday Post, laying out all the reasons why this is a good idea. So we'll see what happens. I probably, you know, some people say that's socialism. Well, why is it socialism to give medical care to people over 65? Why is that not socialism? Or a better question is, if it's okay to have health care for those over 65, why is it socialism to help somebody 55 or 15 or 6 months? So anyway, think about that. And incidentally, any book that I sell, I've written 14 now, any book I sell, royalties go to a little foundation we have that Eleanor and I formed before she died on alcoholism. There's a Teresa McGovern Center in Madison, Wisconsin, that I give money to every year, equal to whatever the royalties are on the books I've written. I learned yesterday that the Lincoln book has just become a bestseller. So I tell people that this Lincoln McGovern ticket's pretty good.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.